Welcome to the Beyond Atheism podcast with me, Nathan Alexander, and my co-host, Todd Tavares. Moving beyond questions of God's existence, this podcast asks what atheists should be doing next in a godless world.
With us today is Gregory Scharzer. Greg Scharzer is an assistant professor, teaching stream in the Center for Teaching and Learning at the University of Toronto Scarborough in Canada. He writes and speaks on a broad variety of topics, and his scholarship explores the connections between politics, economics, geography, cultural studies, and philosophy, with contemporary pop culture analysis woven throughout. He's the author of No Local, Why Small-Scale Alternatives Won't Change the World, and the forthcoming book, Late Escapism and Contemporary Neoliberalism, Alienation, Work, in Utopia, to be published by Routledge. Greg, thanks for coming to Beyond Atheism.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to talk to yourself and Nathan.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Just to start, sort of a basic question, the term neoliberalism is everywhere these days, but maybe you can actually explain like what neoliberalism means.
Sure. To me, neoliberalism is a form of market governance, by which I mean the capitalist state. I'm going to be using that word a lot, capitalist. The capitalist state decides to regulate how wealth is produced and how people produce themselves using a variety of market mechanisms. And many people say neoliberalism is about the end of government, but I think this is actually a misnomer. Neoliberalism is about new rules to encourage private sector regulation of everyday life. So things like privatization, introducing markets into healthcare, which has happened quite a bit in the UK, is firmly established in the US, and our Ontario premier is trying to do that here with vaccine rollouts. But, you know, it extends to so many different aspects of life, including one's very thoughts and self-concept, as I suggest in the book coming out soon.
So one thing that stands out about this is it's tricky for us to work this narrative in some ways, because this sounds like it's a totally secular project. When we think about neoliberalism, is there much room for like religious authority dictating the shape of life in a neoliberal regime?
So are you asking, is there space for that or is there influence?
More the actuality. When we think about a neoliberal project, is it secular? Is it more secular or more religious?
My sense is it's more secular. And that's not to say, you know, the kind of incredible times that you've been living through in the States. And, you know, I think we've seen the kind of the authoritarianism that's been rising globally, in some cases tied to religion, like in Poland, though not always. But I think, I approach the topic from maybe a more matter of individual consciousness. And in that sense, neoliberalism is the end result of what I would see as capitalism destroying all fixed markers of institutional stability, such as the church. Capitalism in that sense no longer needs religion, except in very particular instances where I would say governing elites have found it useful to marry their project of authoritarian market rule to this prosperity theology, which just happens to mimic, grow and be rich. So, you know, sometimes there's a conflation of those messages, but I think its underlying message is that you're on your own. You're stuck here. There's no God coming for you. There's no savior in the afterlife. Better pull yourself up and get to work.
Yeah. Well, I think this is, I'm going to connect this to the question of the other term in the title of your book, the upcoming book, Late Escapism and Contemporary Neoliberalism. So we have this, the second half, what the neoliberal world is. The first term, escapism, because here at Beyond Atheism, we're thinking of like what comes next. It, certainly, neoliberalism sounds like a project after religion. You're connecting it to other things, but already, how you've described it, neoliberalism working either with and against religion, whatever is happening there, it brings to mind this sort of material critique of religion in terms of escapism. And I think like this notion of we project our internal desires onto the afterlife because life here is too painful or desires are too unobtainable. What Marx called, when he referred to religion as the heart of a heartless world, right? The things that we can't have here, the things that are just impossible, the things that make daily life unbearable, we find this in this external realm. And with religion, we certainly see this with the promises of the afterlife. Is this not the form, necessarily the form that you're discussing in your book, but just to flesh out this term escapism, is that what you're discussing as escapism?
I take aim at, I would say, escapism as a marker for anything the particular author disagrees with. So one of the first kind of broad critiques that I look at is by this geographer, Yifu Tuan, who dabbles in ethical philosophy. And he wants to create a kinder, gentler world. And he's a beautiful writer. He wrote a book on escapism, to my knowledge, the only book-length treatment of that topic, where he was sparked by his academic colleagues' disdain for Disney World, whereas he actually quite likes going to Disney World. And so it led him to, you know, think more deeply about what do we get from spaces like these, and he tries to valorize escapism. But in doing that, he arrives in this curious way at this kind of animalistic view of human nature, that escapism can be savage and we can yearn to throw off the shackles of civilization in this almost, it's a very conservative reading of Freud. And he, in some senses, says, no, we need a counterposed escapism. We need a counterposed escapism of balance and meditation and right thinking. And I was perturbed by the lack of analytical clarity at that formulation, but I was not surprised because I just did a quick scholarly search, and one of the earliest articles I found on escapism was from 1936, called The ABC of Escapism. It's by a Catholic theologian. And he's complaining that all these people who don't live Catholic are just being escapist from the reality of the Trinity. And then I thought, well, but what if I don't agree with the reality of the Trinity? Does that automatically make me an escapist and therefore bad? And then I looked and I saw, you know, my background is political science. And so I did a quick review of some of the far left and far right. And I find far left in particular keeps using the term in the same way. They have this thing called facing reality. And if you're not facing reality, if you're indulging in bourgeois art, or some of the Maoists like to say, if you're taking too many drugs or drinking too much, you're escaping. And I thought, no, that's just stuff you don't like. That's not escapism. So when it comes time to applying this to religious analysis, I think it was an easier operation in past times when maybe, and we have to maybe discuss the links or breakages between spirituality and religion. When religion, I mean kind of the church hierarchy and the system of power that goes along with it. When there was a functioning, all-powerful church hierarchy hand in glove with the capitalist state, escapism could be named as religion very easily. You know, you bow to the priest every Sunday instead of fighting for your rights in the factory, you know, Monday to Friday. That's a pretty easy equation to make. But now, when that moral authority has either declined or is declining quite precipitously in the US, as I understand it, I think escapism takes on a much more varied meaning. And oddly enough, this recuperates an earlier version of Marxian philosophy. I also engaged with the work of Ernst Bloch, who was a philosopher of religion, but he saw escapism as a move towards utopia. He didn't use the word escapism, I'm projecting a little, but he describes in detail how religion captures this, what you say, you know, the life that you want that is you can't have because your current life is unbearable. It embodies this kind of utopian longing. And he's talking strictly on an individual level. He's not talking about church power at all. But I think that to me speaks to a much truer version of escapism, that what are we escaping from if not a life that is bereft of meaning? And then how do people find meaning? In many cases, is through this spiritual connection or spiritual relationship, which I, as a theorist, thinker, or individual, reject, but I'm trying to understand its significance.
So yeah, so this is a bit of a genealogy of escapism. And I mean, we've touched on a lot being like, one, escapism is people who are sort of, you know, when you talk about people denying church authority or the Trinity or whatever, people who are dissident or disagreeable, they're being escapist. There's another line that's this sort of functionalist Marxist thinking that is an institution that seeks to overcome this stuff. And another, like you were saying, that Freudian society or civilization and its discontents, the people who want to throw off the shackles of civilization and return to their nature, red in tooth and claw. But maybe we can, you can sharpen it to your point in the book. Is this just an examination of the uses of escapism, or do you make a positive argument on behalf of escapism?
Yes and yes, to answer your question. The reason I went off on an admittedly long tangent there is to show you that there are many different ways escapism is being used. And I think there is a good way to use escapism, and that's as an analytical tool to understand what we lack from capitalist society. And that doesn't mean valorizing particular forms of escapism. It doesn't mean I'm suddenly pro video games or pro alcoholism. I mean, these are all different separate discussions, but it does mean suggesting there's something fundamentally wrong, I would say alienated, at the heart of our society that keeps driving these responses. And unless we understand what that motivation is, we're going to be bouncing back and forth. You know, this escapism is bad, let's confront things, versus no, no, it's good, I need to let off some steam. I find that that dichotomy doesn't really get us anywhere.
I guess the thing is, like, how do you keep sort of escapism from just being, yeah, something that distracts you from your present sort of condition? How do you make it into something more active, I guess, like that provides some kind of blueprint for moving past your like current conditions?
And active is the key word there. Now, I'm going to disappoint you a little. In my last chapter, I think I call it The Politics of Escapism. And I end up fairly harshly, I mean, that's a little unfair to myself, fairly rigorously critiquing those who attempt to enact escapism, by which I draw upon the examples of the everyday utopians, drawing upon some of the work I did for my previous book, No Local, where it seems to me that as soon as you try to create escapism in practice through small-scale ethical communities, you end up basically reproducing the contradictions of the bigger society, but in miniature, in your own little space. So I find, on the one hand, we can't have escapism as a political end in of itself, which is my end ram around all those people who are quite rarely going to say, but escapism is useless. I'm like, yeah, I know.
Well, can you walk us through some of those? What are some examples of escapism that you would, and their uses? Can you give us the examples of uses? I think, like, we've heard religion, Disney World, and local co-ops.
And maybe drugs and alcohol and things like that.
And yeah, drinking. You've brought that one up a lot. So how do they put some meat on the bones to how these are, how they're forms of escapism?
I think they shield us from alienation. Now, one of the premises that I ask readers to consider for the book is that we all exist in a life-denying, alienated society. It's not the case that we are put here on earth free to choose our path, and then some of us take the right one and some of us take the wrong one, which is the sense I get from some of the moral philosophy I was reading. It is more the case that we have to work, and work itself is a twisted expression of our creative capacities. From that, we seek ways out of alienated social relations, the kinds we have with our employers and also with our community and at our homes. Now, The extent to which these actually provide ways out is, of course, contested. I wouldn't deny that for a second. These are all temporary measures. But just because they're temporary doesn't mean they don't provide real relief. And some of the examples I use in the book, I look at Detroit techno, which was self-consciously escapist on the part of its progenitors. I look at some of the early golden era hip hop, which consciously draws on escapism. I do, one of my favorite parts of the book is where I contrast early Public Enemy to late Public Enemy, where they start off denouncing escapism and then 17 years later, they come back and say, well, maybe we really need to take it seriously. And then finally, I look at escapism as a shared collective assertion of humanity. And I do that through examining ARMY, the global fan base of BTS.
So these are, those two aspects strike me as radically different on the basis of how they're overcoming alienation. And like, as you addressed it, like our essence of human creativity, the human essence as creative social beings. When we think about hip hop and Public Enemy, I mean, I think Sun Ra is someone even before that, who's very much, I think he's like Afrofuturism, very escapist in the sense of transcending, finding something different. But that act itself seems to overcome alienation, right? That they are being artistically, creatively, socially productive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely an attempt to overcome alienation to the extent you can within the current confines.
Right. But now that's at an individual level. And they, to a certain extent, I mean, Chuck D of Public Enemy has turned that into his career, right? He's sort of actualized himself and overcome that alienation. But you're talking about the other end when we talk about BTS fandom. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because there's...
Maybe we should just say who BTS is for the uninitiated.
Okay, Greg, two things. What is BTS? And two, tell us how they overcome alienation through this escapism. What form does this escapism take and how is it overcoming?
So I'm going to have to back up just a little to answer that question, because I think there's quite a legit critique within that, which is that cultural production cannot overcome alienation of work. I 100% accept that. There is no freedom for the artist. And even Herbert Marcuse, the great philosopher of alienation, says that if you're an artist, chances are you've managed to scrape away some little niche inside capitalist society, but that puts you in a tiny minority and it's not generalizable. And then many theorists later said art services capital in many different ways. We don't need to go into that. So my point is that escapism from work is necessary because work is alienating and it's always partial. And in the workplace, that can take even tiny forms like sabotage, daydreaming, extra long smoke breaks, etc. There's a long history of kind of a scholarship, I would say, about hidden worker resistance, which I think can usefully be categorized as escapism. That said, people are not at work all day, every day. And for most of the time, they're not actively resisting or actively acquiescing. So they need to structure their mind in other ways. You know, you need to portion off parts of yourself, which some theorists of work I talk about this kind of second hidden self that exists, that is protected. And in there, those kind of feelings reside. Where do those feelings go? They go to things like ARMY, which is, I'm not going to remember the acronym, but for the Bulletproof Boy Scouts, South Korea's biggest K-pop band ever, with a global fan base counted in the millions, who are capable of getting their YouTube video counts up from nothing to a billion in a few months, and are intensely, fiercely loyal, to the point where if you say something racist about Korea or BTS, as some unfortunate disc jockeys have done, you basically are out of a job because ARMY is going to come for you. And this is, to my mind, among other things, an intense expression of escapism from the very alienated social relations that the fan base find themselves in on a day-to-day basis. They can't control their daily lives for any number of reasons, but they can control this space, which can be created in a cooperative, non-toxic, and a collaborative way, right? You can build something that people, you know, people devote so much free time to this. And this is not just, to my mind, what marks us out from an everyday utopian community. This is not just a few dozen people trying to create a perfect world. They're not trying to create a perfect world. They know they can't. They are trying to express their love for the band and through that for this community that they've been able to create. And one of the, I think, the outcomes of that I was so impressed by was during the Black Lives Matter protests last June. You might have heard about this. BTS pledged $1 million for anti-racism, and their fan base matched that million in a day, I think, online. This is, and it's quite remarkable, actually, for K-pop groups to come out so strongly, so early against anti-Black racism. And they really led the way there. So to me, this is an example of kind of the positive uses of escapism. You can take that alienation, repackage it, put all that energy into a new community, and create positive social outcomes.
Just to sort of be more critical, I mean, you mentioned like just that they knew that they're not going to create a new world or something like that. It seems that there's sort of limits to what you can do. I mean, you can like do something positive, but in the end, maybe it doesn't, it's still kind of a tinkering at the edges or something like that. I mean, do you think that's fair or?
That is 100% fair. You're absolutely right. I would make no claims that escapism represents a revolutionary force in the sense of the political project. I do claim that I think any political program that engages with culture, and I go quite a bit into Lukács on this, the Hungarian revolutionary, has to engage with consciousness. In other words, how do people understand their society and their position as part of the working class? And I think escapism is actually a huge part of that that's being neglected, but there is nothing programmatic that comes out of it. However, I would say that this debate has taken place on many different terrains, art, music, literature. Everyone's asking, what does it do? and when they try to make it do something, you end up with like socialist realism, which is just terrible. So I think if you remove that pressure, you can, and just observe rather than being, what's the word, prescriptive about it, then you can observe how people express their distance from their alienation through their escape activities.
Yeah. But if I could pick up on one of the threads there, that rather than think about this as programmatic revolution or having this very specific world-changing end goal, one of the things you mentioned in there is really relevant for us when we think about a world beyond atheism. Because one of the problems atheists have to deal with is meaning. Right? What gives meaning in the world? And this goes back to, you know, Nietzsche and the death of God, this idea that like, if that's the source of all meaning, when you're raised religious, when your society is built on a religion, everything comes from God, all of the meaning in your life, all the values in your life. When we eliminate that, that foundation is gone. When you get rid of God, you get rid of religious authority, that foundation of meaning and value totally disappears, and it has to be recreated some way. And what I noticed in your discussion of the BTS army is what they were doing through this escapism was projecting and recreating socially and collectively what those particular values were, what the meaning was, right? They're able to turn their fandom into Black Lives Matter valuation, right? Showing that anti-Black racism, white supremacy is wrong, which isn't necessarily, it's not part of a revolutionary program, but it's a valuable part of that. Are there other times where we've seen escapism create or reify social values, even in the absence of a revolutionary program?
I would be the first to admit that in academic parlance, escapism is understudied. One of the things, as a concept, just because it has so much baggage, is basically a term of abuse for so many people. And one of the things, If you look for escapism, you're going to find it, but no one's looking for it. So where might we find it? Well, I do think there's tremendous examples in art, music, and literature. I think, you know, many people call these utopian impulses. I wouldn't go that far. Utopian to me seems a little more programmatic, a little more worked out. I think escapism is almost a precursor to utopia. To know what the perfect world might be, you need to understand what you're running from, first of all. The only kind of gesture towards, say, a meta-narrative philosophical meaning, I would say, is escapism is humanist. And this is a very humanist book in that sense. I do think the meaning we create comes from human community, which I think is the best example of atheism. You know, we are not these isolated bourgeois individuals stuck on the island looking to exploit the other shipwreck survivors. We are always already a human society that needs to work together. So how can we do that without illusions? I think escapism, when it, the means, the methods you're referring to and the outcomes you're referring to, escapism is at its best when it kind of encompasses those values.
But I think, I mean, even if I think about something like Disney World, right, there are both, you know, covert and overt values that it's espousing. Riding on It's a Small World is definitely, it definitely has a message. There's definitely value. There's definitely meaning. Very humanistic as well. It's also very commercial. So let's pivot a little bit towards humanism. Is there more that you can add to this? This is something that we run into all the time, but we've never, on the podcast, we've never talked explicitly about humanism. It's often, we often hear it in combination with secular humanism. It's something that's a small part of how atheists and agnostics sort of self-define. Can you just elaborate on this, the humanistic aspects of escapism?
I can, and stop me if it starts getting too esoteric or obscure, because I need to explain a little bit of the theoretical background that informs its humanism, and it's not the secular humanist tradition. So back in the 40s and 50s, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting this intellectual tradition, hopefully your listeners can take me up on it if I am, there was a huge debate in the global communist movement when the crimes of Stalin were revealed by Khrushchev. Stalin dies 3 years later. They're like, no, actually, he was a terrible guy. He targeted all the Jewish doctors. He, you know, killed the revolutionaries, et cetera, et cetera. And the official communist response was, no, we need a humanism. We need to recognize that we represent the highest human values of brotherhood, fraternity, global love, blah, 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 blah. And there was an intense reaction to this on the part of some Marxist theorists working within the international communist tradition, most famously Louis Althusser, who said, you're full of shit. Actually, it's humanism that creates this reified concept of human nature, which is ahistorical and doesn't explain anything. And in fact, can create just as bad a dictatorship as the kind of dictatorship you claim you want to avoid, because as soon as you have a human nature outside of consciousness, whoever claims it gets it. So, you know, I'm the state regime. I say that people are this way. If you disagree with me, you're going back to the gulag. So this is, you know, I think in fairness, that's what he was trying to accomplish. And he was proposing instead a structuralist approach. So a lot of the philosophy in the 50s and 60s comes out of this humanist structuralist axis, where it's like, no, we don't need the individual. We need to understand how power works, how fields of ideology interact with each other, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, out of this comes Marxist psychoanalysis and humanist psychoanalysis, of which my favorite representative is Eric Fromm, who oddly enough gets criticized for being religious, but I don't think he was. He says, no, we need the individual, but we have to start with recognizing the individual is alienated. They come from what he called, you know, the giant bureaucratic machine that was all the rage back then. They are suppressed and ground down by these faceless systems of power that confront them. So we need to understand what it does to their psychology, and we should reassert individualism. Now, you can say that the world has moved on from the giant machines of power. I think power is quite happy to, you know, as long as you do your business, it lets you alone. But I would say the global reach and impact of capital through neoliberalism has created a much more micro sense of self. And it manages that micro sense of self on a much more individual scale. From that really intensely personally felt alienation comes an intensely personal need for escapism. So that's where I see, and I talk about this in the book, a negative humanism being a good kind of catch-all for escapism. In other words, we are human, and we have to be humanist, but it has to be a response to the negating impact of alienation. So we basically need structure and agency. We need them together. We need human, not an essence, although I would say, and I argue this in the book, that Marx talks about humanity as being creative. That is something that defines humanity. But we need to understand that as being almost ground down and then reasserted through everyday acts of escapism.
So basically it's this, there are these two forces at work here. One is the capitalist mode of production is inherently alienating. And the reaction to that is these forms of escapism. And escapism is where we get to reclaim our humanism, or where we can reestablish it. And this, you seem to be promoting a very positive idea, positive in the sense that it's good. Like escapism has a value. There's something that we can get out of it, even if it's limited. Is that fair to say?
There's something we can learn from it. We can't ignore it.
I wanted to go a little more into this. Like even the ideas, we've touched on a little bit of like the collective forms, even more individual ideas of what we think of as escapism. I mean, some of what you describe were the weapons of the weak, you know, long cigarette breaks, other things being that sort of like self-destruction that we sometimes see, drugs and drinking, that are like self-medicating. But I'm wondering, something that we haven't talked about are those like small acts of very individual escapism that can be seen as almost utopic sometimes, and things like daydreaming, you know, wish fulfillment. Yeah, just daydreaming, fantasizing. Are these are acts of escapism, are they not?
They are, and I do spend some time on the concept of fantasy, as articulated by Marcuse, he puts play at the essence, at the heart of human creative expression, and capitalism destroys play through its emphasis on performance. I would have spent more time on things like wish fulfillment, but that, Ernst Bloch, the guy got there first. He spends quite a bit of he has essays on this in his Principle of Hope, which is wonderful.
Well, it's okay for you to expand on it here. It doesn't have to necessarily be in the book.
Yes. No, that's a very good point. I'm in agreement. I think this is absolutely true. There is, what surprises me is these are so common and yet so neglected. Why don't we valorize these things? And I think the reason why, at least coming from the left, is that they're not revolutionary. They don't get you to a movement. So people are like, well, this is bullshit. This is a waste of time. And I agree, there is a danger. This is what No Local is about. If you take these small acts of resistance and count them as additive, then you're in trouble. That doesn't go anywhere. But if you see them as indicative as a generalized alienation, this is a stunning indictment of capital to me. This says that everybody keeps feeling this way and no one can talk about it because they don't want to lose their job. They don't want to appear like they're not a team player. I have one statistic from Gallup, I think, where they did a global poll of worker disengagement and discovered 70% of workers around the world actively dislike their jobs. And it's very funny because he says that the president of the firm writes on this, how many polls they must do. He takes this one and he says, if this is true, it means the end of civilization. I mean, those are his words. And I think that's hilarious because, like, inadvertently, he's kind of stumbled on something there. And why should that be the realm of capitalist hand-wringing? Well, why can't we take that for ourselves?
Oh, no, that's good. Because, I mean, the thing is, we can, there's a lot of ways we can spend time just sort of going back and forth, thinking about like how much people dislike their job and what people do with their jobs. And things like, I remember having very strong feelings for a while at one particular job, saying, I wish I had more time at a computer so I could spend more time looking for new jobs. And that was kind of like, that was the goal, right? Like, and even that, in a lot of ways, it was, I mean, we know, we get this sense of how much of it is sort of fantasizing and escape, but also it's active work, but just fantasizing about spending time looking for a new job, it's, that's pretty messed up. And I'm sure companies must know how much time their employees spend looking for different jobs.
Wow. I guess you've heard about some of the software they're trialing in the UK where they'll track your eye movements when you're working from home. And if you look away from the screen, a little robot pops up and says, see, you seem to be distracted. Is there anything I can help you with? Yes, this is being systematized already.
The thing I was going to ask was, I mean, assuming in some future, like we advance from capitalism to a different kind of way of doing things, I mean, do you think there's something like fundamental about escapism that it's always going to be sort of with us, like regardless of what the situation is, or is it sort of like it, like a necessary kind of inevitable feature of like neoliberalism and capitalism?
Well, I guess I would like to say that escapism is so tentative precisely because of the pressures of alienation. You know, we are not allowed to express our feelings about our work, our coworkers, our living conditions, except in safe ways. And often those, you know, go online and read some of the forums about people's lives, and you see it coming out. But, you know, in daily life, in practice, to the people that could change things, you're not allowed to say that because your jobs are on the line. And sometimes your housing. So if escapism is a tentative form of utopianism, I would like to think that in a future unalienated society, we could abandon it. We could be, you know, unabashedly utopian and say, you know, we want the collective solar farms making, you know, carbon neutral oil paints for the new army of painters that has just sprung up because they don't have to work. There's got to be, you know, escapism in this sense is an expression of timidity. But isn't it shocking that how many billions of people seem to be so timid?
Right. No, I see what you mean. Like, we are in a political arena where one of the biggest selling points is job creation, right? Like, it's a very generic, it's used all the time by both sides. Everybody wants job creation. But I think if we were really saying what we really felt and what we really wanted, we'd be saying, I want to work less. That would be our political goal. But we're not allowed that. So that we need this political, a realm where we have a political imaginary, a collective imaginary, where we can sort of at least have that outlet and start to say these things. And that the mark of overcoming alienation would be that either we say these things or we have the means to address them. Something like that?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I see where you're going. Yeah, that's a very good point. What you're saying reminded me of the whole, the quote you mentioned from Marx at the start, the heart in a heartless world. I mean, it's just going to say it's not a coincidence that some of the most fundamental churches operate for the most marginalized people. They are providing the kind of sustenance that is stripped away from, you know, their daily lives on the margins. And, you know, what if that energy was redirected towards some sort of collective wish fulfillment that had a possibility of being realized?
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of see how, I mean, it's almost like a historical condition if we put this entirely in the realm of religion, right? Where we would have to imagine a society that's more directly dictated by religious authorities because of how sort of limiting what that world could be, right? Where they are, if we're thinking very, very broadly. But it does, I mean, it, like you just said, like these sort of, these smaller areas, they do kind of work as, there is that functionalism. Let's get this out of the way. Like, churches do serve social functions that are in some ways utopian and do match their ideals. To me, like, having this discussion with you makes me see a lot of churches as, though, when they fulfill those roles, it sounds much more escapist, right? This is, we're going to project our values that are not the values of the capitalist realm that, that we're all embedded in. We're going to try to attempt to have palliatives, right? Because they're not revolutionary. They're not changing the structure. We're going to have soup kitchens, food banks. We're going to have AA. We're going to have, you know, go door to door with medicine if that's something we can do to help. But it is not something that people are creating themselves. It comes from this very strict form of alienation where you're the subject, right? Or you're the object. It all comes from God. It comes from religious authorities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wilhelm Reich, the Marxian psychoanalysis, he wrote a book about it. He's writing about fascism, but you know, his famous pamphlet, "Listen, Little Man," and he's saying, stop trying to lose yourself in the mass. You know where this ends up? Well, it doesn't end up with orgones, let's put it that way. Clearly this is a vicious stick impulse. I read a bit about that in the book. But I would say, I mean, you're familiar with this, but some of the writing on religion as an organizing tool for society talks about how religion is basically, the church we're talking here, has taken over the state functions in many failed states, let's say, or states are designated as failed. And that is clearly inseparable from how the capitalist order is organized in that particular place. These two have to be understood together, I think.
One of the best sort of visualizations, physical representations of alienation I'd ever seen is the church on the top of, I think it's Sacred Heart, on the top of Montmartre in Paris, where it was after the destruction of the Paris Commune, they basically build this monument to people being subservient to the church. And it takes, right, it's like, we've destroyed all of your power, we've forced you, we've taken your money, we've taken your labor to build this giant church to remind you, never do that again. It's such an inversion of your labor power, right? You're building the source of your own oppression.
The you know, it's 150th anniversary of the Paris Commune this year. Paris is mounting all sorts of celebrations, and I believe the conservatives, as well as the people who run that church, are objecting for that very reason. It's like, don't you people appreciate, you know, the traditions that we've built? Look at this beautiful church.
Yeah. Right. Why are we celebrating something so horrible? It continues, right? It's that same source of alienation.
I was just going to ask, like, you've sort of touched on it a little bit already, but like, how does this book sort of relate to some of the themes in your previous book, No Local?
When I started this book, I saw it as a continuation of No Local. I think I was in much more, it's coming from a more orthodox leftist perspective, in which, you know, here are different ways people are confronting reality. and then, you know, after I spent many years in a rather precarious labor market and precarious living situations, I think I really gained a new appreciation for how valuable this stuff is. But perhaps out of sheer stubbornness or, you know, not wanting to admit a false step, I still hold by the analysis of No Local. I really do think there are objective limits to how building a small-scale alternative can outmaneuver capitalism. I just don't think it can, unless it's supported by wealthy backers. But the impulse to create a local alternative away from society when you have no other recourse, I can see that as legitimately escapist. I mean, I wish people were a lot more critical about the kind of work that goes into that and what that takes away from, I would call, genuine social movements. But there is something about seeing how fucked up the world is and saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if we had a place we could get, you know, fresh local produce in the park every Saturday. just so happens that me and my friends are all white and have nice houses, and so is the farmer, and we're all paying, $6 for our rutabagas. But regardless, wouldn't that be great if we could create this unalienated society in miniature? That's escapist, no question.
You might say that your first book is sort of a particular aspect of escapism, whereas this one is kind of a broader look at it, maybe.
That's a really good way of putting it. I hadn't considered that before, but yeah, I think you're right. The first book, and I will say this, I'm just going to toot my own horn here for a second. I'm getting more requests for information about the first book now, 10 years after I wrote it, than I did when it came out. I just did a podcast about it a few weeks ago. I was interviewed about it for a Spanish newspaper last year. I had just many requests. And it seems that in the kind of neoliberal shock of 2008 that has just intensified, and now with the pandemic, people are actively searching for alternatives. And it's automatic based on the fragmentation of capitalist society and perhaps their particular class positions to go to this, well, why don't we just set up a biofuel collective here? Why don't we just set up a consumer cooperative there? There's a lot more to say about that, which we don't have to get into, but I do think that analysis has legs because of the escapism that you identified kind of runs through both.
Mm. So, and what's that, what did they ask you about? Are there particular things? I know, I think it's Mondragon in Spain was the collectively owned operation. Seen as a model to build upon. I mean, I'm making a jump here, making a big assumption that was something that they were asking about, or something that was in the mind of a Spanish interviewer regarding that. Is that what they were thinking about?
He was asking about local energy production. This was for, I'm going to mispronounce it, El País, their weekly news magazine, and there was a villager setting up a local energy production cooperative, but the problem was they couldn't compete with the national energy regulator. So they're asking for subsidies to please make us viable. And my point was, you cannot be viable when you're going up against economies of scale in a capitalist marketplace. If you want to get state support, that's fine, but this is a step towards nationalization, which is a whole other discussion. It raises questions of political power. So I thought, and Mondragon being the perfect example, because they ended up having to use non-cooperative labor in global sweatshops, I thought that No Local kind of preceded these arguments by a few years. And I guess what I'm saying now with this book is, just as Nathan articulated, you said, is this the escapist impulse starting with No Local and being generalized? I think it is. I really think there's, we have to ask ourselves, why is this happening now? And it's not just the material things, the climate crisis, the housing prospects, the generation gap, blah, 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 blah. It's all those things. But it's more importantly, what does that do to our consciousness? How do we perceive this? And I think there's a pattern here.
Where do you see new avenues of escapism? And when I'm asking this, things that we haven't touched on, but that are huge, are things like the video game industry, which is just massive. But totally, I mean, it's totally colonized by large, it's tough to say producers, but it's large companies, basically. It's aimed at profit. It's not about a creative impulse. Most games give you this sort of illusion of freedom, of complete control, even in this sort of the massive multiplayer online role-playing games, things like that. That seems to be a frontier of escapism. Is this something that you've given much thought to? And if it hasn't, what are some areas you think we'll see a growth of escapism into?
The fact that the video game industry is so huge, I mean, much bigger than Hollywood as I understand it, oddly enough, does leave some interstices for progressive escapism. And the only reason that I say this, and this is not scientific, there are journals dedicated to ludic studies, as there should be, and I'm no expert, but there are online forums dedicated to socialist gaming, which if you go on Reddit, there's a few of them, and they will pick out instances of either user-made cooperative gaming platforms or even socialist characters or lines in games. So I think there's kind of, there's small echoes or ripples of progressive escapism going on in the video game industry. But by and large, I agree. This is dedicated to taking people away from their problems. I'm a firm believer that video games don't cause anything, just like heavy metal didn't cause anything and social ills. So then we have to ask ourselves, why is it so big? Is it that suddenly everyone's like, we've discovered a new dopamine addiction? It's like, or is it just the world outside is just not giving us very much dopamine? And in that sense, I would argue as a theorist of escapism that we need to engage with video games just as seriously. There's been a little bit about escapism from a psychological perspective applied to video games, but it tends towards the old, does it do harm, does it not axis, because that's the question that gets funding. And I'm not that interested in that question. I think it's been answered many times over. I think the major question is, to what extent do the way we use video games, to what extent does it prefigure non-alienated ways of life, or at least express them in some way? And I really think it does in many ways, even these major platforms.
Yeah. What you continually touch upon here, which I think is astounding, is that we feel that we have a problem, right? People have a need to escape from the actual material reality, and how ought we choose to do it, and what ought we take away from it. And what's astounding about this to me is that there isn't a sense of spirituality brought into it. It's not about what God wants. It's not searching these great eternal truths that have been with humanity forever. The way that you've encapsulated all this, it's completely, it's atheistic, right? It's completely secular. This is a real world material issue, and we need to deal with it in a real world material way where we engage creatively, collectively, and imaginatively. Like, for me, thinking about trying to find how this really connects to the project of what Beyond Atheism is, I think that this is sort of one of those sort of like perfectly atheistic problems. Right? How do we do this? How do we make the world that we want in the absence of God without being told by people who know something through revelation or because they saw this 6,000-year-old book? It's like, this is a very contemporary framing. It's a very secular atheistic framing of the atheist project. So I'd like to thank you so much for bringing this to us. It's a hell of a lot to digest. When is your book going to be released?
It is coming out at the moment, late July. This summer. I should mention that it is coming out on hardback for $160 US. So perhaps if this podcast has a website, I'm happy to supply my email. And if anyone wants to get in touch with me for a review copy, I can send them a PDF.
Yeah. Okay. we'll definitely do that. But I think actually your No Local is probably might be more affordable. I'm not sure.
Yes. That's $20 Canadian. I'm not sure the US, maybe 15 US. But and likewise, again, I know times are tough. If people want a review copy, please get in touch. I'd be happy to send them.
All right. Thanks, Greg, for chatting with us. It was fun.
It's my pleasure. Thank you both for your excellent questions.
Thanks for the answers. All right. I think that's pretty good. We did it.
That was fun. We should say, like, Greg is an old friend of ours, so it was fun chatting with him. What did you take away from that episode?
Man, that book is gonna be heavy. It's I haven't read that one. I've read No Local, and it's incredibly accessible and pretty sharp. And like you pointed out today, like, this does fit in pretty well, right? Those ways that we try to solve our life problems and they don't work.
Yeah, I think he's right just about, like, the fact the fact that there is this escapist impulse, I guess, is a sign that like something's going on, I guess. Yeah. I think that's an interesting point. And to just sort of like think about what that actually means. Mm. So yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, just the way he brings up it to those
the local. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Those ideas that he marries and brings together about how like we have how neoliberalism creates this tremendous alienation of ourselves from each other and from our ideas and our desires and our creativity, and finds in it like this urge to escape it that doesn't necessarily produce, or he claims it doesn't actually produce any of those changes at all. But it does also remind us that like bring to the religion back to it, like religion does do that alienation, right? It sort of removes ourselves from the material world and puts us under the rules of something else. We don't get to decide. Mm-hmm. We don't have choices. We aren't allowed volition. We have to submit to the will of some deity. And how do we overcome that?
Mm-hmm.
That alienation. At least that's where my head went, Nathan. I don't know. Did you find anything particularly insightful that you want to expound on for the audience?
Well, maybe. I guess we didn't necessarily talk about this directly, but I guess just that there are like. Maybe there are better and worse forms of escapism, perhaps. Mm. Like there are more or less productive forms of escapism, I think. I would say that that's something to think about.
Right. It's different. It's one thing to take a trip to Disney World or to daydream. It's another to use your BTS fandom to create norms of behavior in the world, anti-racist norms of behavior.
Right.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting if, in some way, like the BTS fans will find this podcast and then will take us to the top of the charts or something like that.
Totally. Totally stan us, you guys. Do it.
Yeah. That would. Yes, yeah. That would be ideal.
And to think about other ways people are alienated. If people have other ways that you're alienated or ways that you like to escape, other forms of escapism, hit us up at NathGAlexander at Twitter. Is that correct? Is that you?
Yes. Yep.
Fantastic. Use that. I'm on Facebook, but I'm an internet hermit. I'm never really there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lurking on my own Facebook page. That's that. Anything else we need to plug?
We need to plug the podcast to encourage people to subscribe and follow and rate and review and all that sort of stuff.
Right. Ring the bell, pull the string, whatever it is.
Yep. All of the above.
Yep. Big thanks to Red Japan.
Yes.
Flawless performance.
Yes.
Yeah, what else we got? And Nathan Alexander, Todd Tavares.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it. And there we go.
See everyone next time.